My name's Kip Collins, and I'm an alcoholic. I haven't had a drink all day long. Didn't hurt nobody today. Didn't hurt myself. I worked all week, paid my way. You know, my family was sad to see me go tonight, and they're looking forward to me coming home. And might not impress y'all, but that sure does please my mother. My sobriety date's May 12, 1984. My home group is Robber's Roost, and my sponsor's name is Pat T. I want to thank Willie and my sis, Barbara, for bringing me down here. I don't know if you ladies don't know this lady over here, you ought to get to know her. She saved my life. I would not be here tonight if it wouldn't have been for Barbara. I love her with all my heart, man. I detoxed on her couch so many times. She's my hero. Thank Kevin for riding up here with me today and letting me listen to you. My father is Irish and Sioux, and my mother's Irish and Cherokee, and my daddy liked to drink, and my mama liked to fight. And the way it was, you'd wait around for the old man to get home. The longer it took, the madder my mom got. After a while, you'd hear that truck coming up the road, and you look out the windows, you'd see all the neighbors turning off their lights, grabbing their lawn chairs, and coming outside. My mom took no prisoners, you know. I mean, she meet him at the door, man, with a butcher knife, and it was on. And that's the way it was, you know. It was like that all the time. I don't blame my alcoholism on my father. I blame it on the San Diego County School District. You know, in the early 60s, they had this great idea that bring in these people and tell us about that stuff that we don't talk about in A&A. And I sat in this auditorium with my buddy Balto, and they showed us this movie, and these guys got up and started talking about this, about what had happened and everything, and they turned the lights back on, and I hit Balto in the ribs. I said, "Can you get some of that?" And he said, "Yeah, man, my dad smokes that stuff all the time." I said, "Cool." And so the next day, we hooked up. I said, "You got it?" He goes, "Yeah." I said, "What do we do?" He goes, "Well, we got to go steal some wine." I said, "What for?" He goes, "I don't know." He said, "But my dad always drinks cheap wine with this stuff." And, you know, and I was willing to go to any lengths, and I didn't want to make any mistakes. And so, you know, I went in this little store, and I boosted my first short dog a sweet red port. Went down this canyon, fired up this joint. I took a hit off of it, started coughing my brains out. I gave it to Balto. I took my wine, pulled that screw cap off, took a big pull, immediately threw up. And here's the part that I don't understand. You know, they say that alcoholics, we don't have willpower. I took another pull off that jug, and it hit my gut, and it started to bounce. And I pushed it back down, and it started to come back up, and I pushed it back down again. You know, it just kind of yo-yoed on me there for a little while. And I held it down, you know, and I took another one, and it did the same thing, and I held it down. And that third one went down pretty easy. And I finished off that pint of wine, and I sit back in this grass. And I laid up, and I looked at the sky, and I experienced my very first spiritual awakening. That's not funny, man. I'm serious, you know. That was the most magic moment of my life. You know, I was raised in an all-Hispanic neighborhood. My cousins are all Indian. They have dark hair, dark skin, brown eyes. And I go outside. I was born with white hair, white skin, and blue eyes. And I went outside. The Mexicans wanted to beat my ass. I went in the house. Indians wanted to beat my ass. You know? And I knew I was different, and I was terrified of this world. And when I drank that alcohol, the very first time in my life, I was 12 years old, I had never known how much terror I was in at all times, but it just kind of disappeared and the fear went away. the fear just went away, and I laid there, and I was just totally content. And I never felt that way before. And I immediately, with no reservation, turned my will and life over to that. And I never looked back. You know, a couple years later, I got kicked out of school, San Diego Unified School District, for hitting a teacher for the second time. And when I got home, my mom had found my stash. And, you know, my mom, I got the greatest mom in the world. I take care of her to this day. I see my mother every day, and I financially support her. And she's one of my heroes, but that is the meanest woman I've ever known in my life. I watched her stab my dad 2 times in my life, and she knocked out the next door neighbor with a shovel for talking back to her. And she had my respect, I'll tell you, you know. And my mother says to do something, and she's got a certain look in her eye, you just say, yes, ma'am, you know, and that, you better not say anything other than that. And she looked at me, she goes, what's this? I said, it's marijuana. She goes, get out of my house. And I said, yes, ma'am. And I was gone, you know. I was 14 years old. I'd never been anywhere. I'd never done anything. And I went over to a friend of mine's house in Carlsbad. I said, what are you going to do? I said, I don't know, you know. And he goes, well, check this out. And he got this newspaper article out. And he said, look, all these people are going up to San Francisco, and all they do is get high and listen to music and make love. I like music, you know. That's about 1965, and I went up to a place called Haight-Ashbury, and sure, in a general way, I've always been grateful to God of my understanding that I'm not allergic to penicillin. I found out almost immediately that I was probably the worst hippie that ever got there. You know, I grow hair real good, but I've been fighting all of my life. And these people were very pacifist. And man, I was just constantly getting in fights there right on the streets. And that was just very socially unacceptable there. And I just didn't get it. But I found out what my true calling was. You know, I'm actually just a capitalist pig, you know, because I saw opportunity. I just saw opportunity everywhere. All these people, they want this stuff. All my friends come from Mexico. I know where this comes from. I can put two and two together. And I called my buddy Balto. We got down to Mexico. We started a little business, and everything went real nice. And until I was arrested in Mexico when I was 16 and sent to prison in Mexico. And I was at La Mesa Federal Penitentiary. And I'll tell you something. Nice things don't happen to 16-year-old boys with long blonde hair in a Mexican prison. And if anything in the world, that experience ought to have taught me that I need to change the way I'm living. But you know, my friend Balto, his family, he had members in there. And he hooked up. He got me protection. I got involved with some people in there, and it turned out to be one of the greatest career moves of my life, actually. I'm not going to go into that, but I got out of there. I came back to the United States. I continued doing what I was doing. I went to prison again on my 18th birthday at 5:30 in the morning. I got out of that, you know, while I was in there. I'd been living with this gal, and she was pregnant. She never wrote me. Her family moved her out of state, and I never got to find out about the baby. And it was kind of empty place in my life, you know. I wondered about that baby. No one ever told me if it was a boy or a girl. And, you know, I hooked up with this gal. This new product came into California. It was made by a company called Roar. And I just did the stupidest things on that stuff. And they just kept locking me up. I didn't do anything criminal, just stupid stuff, right in front of God and everybody. And that just locked my ass up, you know. And there was this little gal I was running around with, and she kept bailing me out of jail. She bailed me out of jail 3 times in 1 week. And the last time, I said, how come you keep bailing me out of jail? And she looked me right in the eye with this very puzzled look, and she goes, well, what else would I do? And I married her, you know. So I like the way you think, you know. And, And me and Kathy, we launched on to a course of vigorous action. And she was the greatest crime partner I've ever had in my life. Was not afraid of anybody or anything. And was in the same pursuit I was. The pursuit of pleasure and the avoidance of pain. You know, and that was our motto. You know, I push it to the metal as far as we can go, man. Let's see. Let's go. Lean against, stand on the cliff and lean against the wind, you know. And that's the way we lived. And it was good. We had some good, good times. You know, I got arrested again. I went to jail, got out. I was on parole. I knew I'd never make parole in California. I went up to a little town in Oregon, me and her. And while we were up there, she got pregnant. And we're still doing our thing. And one day she said, you know, we got to go to the hospital. I said, what's up? She goes, we're going to have the baby today. I went, wow, really? And we went to the hospital. And I waited in this room. And after a while, they came out and they brought this little boy. And they put this little boy in my arms. And I experienced my second spiritual awakening. When they put that little boy in my arms, something inside of my heart of hearts happened that I wasn't expecting. I fell absolutely head over heels in love, unconditionally, with another human being. And I had never known that feeling. And I looked at this little boy, man, and I promised him. I said, you know what, man, you're my pal. No one's ever going to hurt you. You're always going to have all this stuff, man. Me and you are going to do things. You count on me. And I meant it with everything I had. You know, I came back to California after I got off parole up there, and it was time for us to go to another hospital. I went out and I waited in this hospital, and they came out and they put this little girl in my arms. And the same thing happened. My heart just exploded, and I looked at this little girl and I fell head over heels in love. And I promised her, I said, you know, you're my baby, nothing will ever hurt you. I'll never allow anything to hurt you. I'll protect you from this world, and you're going to have all the stuff. And I meant it with everything I had. You know, the next 5 years, alcohol and drugs were not a problem in my life. It wasn't getting in my way of anything. I partied and did when it was time to party, but I had a choice of when I could do it. And I was working for an organization. I worked maybe once or twice a year. And things were good. You know, I spent all my time with my kids. I had a nice, real nice place in Vista, and it was fixed up for my kids. And, you know, I got up in the morning, and I fixed them breakfast. I played with them all day. I taught them how to walk. I taught them how to talk. I took care of my kids every single day. That's what my life was about. And on September 6, 1976, my wife and my daughter went to the store to go get, they were school clothes shopping because school was getting ready to start. And me and my son were playing in the yard. And a friend of mine came over and he brought this stuff you smoke over. And we smoked this stuff and he left. You know, it was real hot that day and I got real, real thirsty. And I wanted an ice cold beer so bad. And I didn't even think about it. I just got on my bike. I put it up to the store. It was right around the corner. I got a six-pack. I came back down the hill. And when I pulled into that, down that hill, all the police were in front of my house and the fire department. And all the neighbors were out in front of my house. And I didn't know what had happened, you know. But I walked through, got into that crowd, and I found out that my son had chased me out of the driveway. And he'd been run over by a pickup truck. And when I got through that crowd and I saw my son, his head was split open. And I could see his brains, and his ribs were protruding from his chest, and his leg bones were protruding. And the thing I loved the most in this world was laying there all broken, and something inside of me died. I got to the hospital with him, and I sat in that hospital for over 6 months in intensive care. And for 6 months, I couldn't leave. Couldn't leave except to change my clothes, and I'd have to get back, you know. And I don't know nothing about God. Nobody ever taught me nothing about God. I'd heard people talk about it. I'd never been to church or anything. And I'm crying out to any God, you know, please give me back my son. I'll do anything. Just give me back my son. You know, and my son survived that in a way. he emotionally for the rest of his life and mentally never got past the age of about 4 years old. And he spent most of his life in and out of hospitals with one brain surgery after another, 27 major brain surgeries throughout his life. And he was in pain and he couldn't hear and he couldn't talk. And he had severe psychological problems and physical problems all of his life. My brother, Bill, anything I've told you about my brother, Bill, we were 11 months apart. You know, it was always me and Bill. We backed each other's play all of our lives. We were absolutely inseparable. And my brother came down with a mental disease called schizophrenia. Probably one of the most insidious mental disorders there is. And my family had him put in a hospital. And after a while, he called me from that hospital. He said, "Get me out of here, kid. Just get me out of here." And I said, "Are you all right, man?" He said, yeah, they're giving me these pills. Just get me out of here. And, you know, I went against medical advice. I went against my family's wishes. But I'm finagled, and I got my brother out in my custody. And they brought him home with me. He had a mobile home on the property right next to mine. And me and my brother continued doing what we'd always been doing. And he started getting sick. One day, I had to go to work. I had to go back on the East Coast. And I told my brother, Bill, I said, "Bill, watch the kids. I'm going to be back in 3 days." And he was shaking and he was crying. I said, "What's wrong?" He says, "I don't know, man. I'm coming apart." And I gave him a handful of money. The money's fixed everything all my life. And I said, "You know, just hang tight. I'll be back in 3 days. We'll take care of it." You know, and when I left, my brother was standing in the driveway and he was crying. And I have never seen my brother cry in my whole life. And I was just really amazed at that, you know. But I got back doing what I was doing, and this thing went sideways I was doing, and I was gone for 3 weeks. And when I got back, I talked to my daughter. I said, where's Bill? Where's your uncle? She goes, "I haven't seen him, Dad." And I said, "Well, what do you mean you haven't seen him?" She goes, "He's been gone for a long time." And my brother didn't do things like that. And so we went back over to his mobile home, and I opened that door. And I knew before I opened it. But my brother's head rolled out at my feet. And there was just a big pile of maggots in that doorway. My brother, 3 days after I left, had taken his gun and blown his head off. You know, and another big giant piece of me died that day. You know, I tell you this from my heart to yours, that I thank God that I'm an alcoholic. Because if alcohol didn't do for me what alcohol does for me, I would have joined my brother. But alcohol does something real magic to me. Alcohol takes away all the guilt and things I've done. It stops the screaming in my head. It allows me to go to sleep at night. It stops the screaming in the morning. It allows me to live in this world one day at a time, reasonably comfortable, so I don't have to deal with anything. It takes away all those fear, all that stuff. You know. We talk a lot about bottoms in AA. You know, it's been my experience. Thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous, because you can pick a bottom today. You don't have to go where a lot of people had to go anymore. You know, but as long as you can think and feel and have going, anything on between your ears, it never stops getting worse. You know, the people leave and the stuff goes, but that just gives you more freedom to drink. But what really starts happening, the alcohol started taking a little piece of my very soul. Just a little bit more every day. You know, my wife, I became totally dysfunctional, and she didn't know what was going on. She was used to having a lot of money around, man, and I wasn't producing anymore. And she left with one of our connections, and I didn't blame her. And she left me with my little girl. My son was in a special school, and my little girl, she's 5 years old, and her life had been a fairy tale up until then, you know, and she was there with me when I found my brother. You know, and she loved her brother, and she saw what had happened. She loved her mom, and she was gone. And she loved me to death, and I couldn't stop drinking. And she was sitting on the couch, and she was shaking, and she was crying, and she was real scared. And I'm telling her, I said, "Baby, things are just real rough, you know. But we don't need nobody. You know, I'm going to get it together here in just a little bit. You know, I'm going to catch my breath, and I'm going to fix everything, because I don't need nobody. And everything's going to be okay." And this guy came over to my house right after I told her that, and I just got her calmed down. And he brought this stuff I doubt anyone but Wade's ever heard about it. But up in North County, we call it Mad Dog 2020. And you've heard about it, huh? You know, if there's any new people, there was a bunch of them here tonight, you know. God bless you. I'm glad you're here. You know, and I don't know if this is your first meeting. I don't know, probably some of the people here, this is probably your last meeting, you know. But what I would really like to, if you're going to go do it, drink Mad Dog. Mad Dog will run your rusty ass back in here so quick. It don't mess around, man. And I drank this bottle of Mad Dog, and the next thing I know, this lady is saying, "Excuse me, sir, you got to get off the plane." You know, the last thing I knew, I was in my living room. I didn't know anything was going on. And I opened my eyes, and my little girl's sound asleep right next to me. And I'm in this big wide-body jet, and it's completely empty except for me and her. And I looked at this lady, and I'm going, "Where am I?" And she goes, "You're in Fort Lauderdale." And I said, "Florida?" She goes, "Yeah." I said, "I hate Fort Lauderdale." You know, she goes, "I don't know nothing about it. You got to get off the plane." So I got my little girl. I woke her up, and I just very coolly tried to get some information for her without raising undue suspicion that I didn't know what was going on, you know. And basically what she let me know was, she goes, "Are we here?" I said, "Yeah." She goes, "Well, what are we going to do here?" I said, "I don't know." And I tried to question. She said, "Well, I don't know. You woke me up and said, 'Come on, we're leaving.'" And that's where we ended up. And I didn't know what to do, so I called a cab. I said, "Take me to a liquor store and then to a hotel, because I need to sit down and figure out what's happened here." You know, I went to this hotel, and apparently what had happened, I hooked up with a young couple there that was, they were drinking, and they had some of the local additives that allow you to drink a lot more. And we were doing that, and you know, and I started talking to them, and I found out they'd never had any Mad Dog before, so I got some Mad Dog. And apparently, I have no recollection of this, but apparently I went completely insane, butt naked, in the lobby of this nice hotel. And they called the police. The police did, and I ended up in the county mental health, you know. And when I woke up in this room, and I was completely naked, you know, and I was strapped down, 4-point restraints. And, you know, just for a second, I thought I might have missed something real cool, you know. But then these people in white coats come in looking real serious, and I knew, uh-oh. And I talked to the doctor there. I told him I've been through a lot of trauma, and this is a big mistake, you know. And it just, you know, "Listen, I'm from California. Let me out of here. I'm going to get on the next plane. I'm out of your state forever." And the guy said, "Okay," you know, and they let me go. I don't know where my daughter is, though. You know, I haven't got a clue. You can't say anything because they'll call the police. And I don't deal with the police for any reason whatsoever. Under any circumstances do I deal with the police. You know, I'm hoping when I get to my clothes, maybe there's a matchbook or some information in my pockets that'll let me know what's going on. And I'm walking out of this hospital, and here comes my little girl with this young couple walking up the steps. And I grabbed my baby, and I said, "Come on, we're getting out of Florida. I told you this place sucks." For the next couple of years, it never got any different than that. You know, I don't want to go into it, man, because it's all the same story. I went here to try and promise her it's going to be different. I'm going to get it together. And the same thing happened over and over and over and over and over. And we lived in 5 different states over the next 2 years. And in every one of those states, I had to leave at midnight, you know, as fast as I could. And that's just the way it was. Last place, I had to run out of Georgia, and I'm on this bus. I met this real good Christian guy, real nice fellow. And he invited me to, with his family. His dad had a business, and they gave me a job, and they gave me and my little girl a place to live. They started taking me to their church, you know, and they were just the nicest people. And they said I couldn't drink there. And I didn't drink for almost, I think, 2, maybe 3 weeks, and I was absolutely insane. And this guy, we got paid, and he says, come on, I'll go downtown. You want to ride down with me? And we'll cash our checks and I'll buy you a beer. And I said, God bless you. You know, and you know what happened, you know. I came in late that night. And my little girl was sitting there. And she looked up, you know, and I'll never forget the look in her eye. You know, she just went over, picked up her pillow and her doll and stood by the door, and I changed my clothes and we grabbed some things and headed for the bus, and got me a big bottle of wine. Said, we're going back to California, and I got in the back, started drinking my wine, and I passed out. Come to in Gallup, New Mexico. My little girl's sitting there rocking and crying. And I said, what's the matter? She goes, Daddy, I'm hungry. You haven't fed me. I said, as soon as we stop, I'll get you something to eat, you know. Pulled in this place, and I went in this little liquor store, and I was so sick. And I got a bottle of wine, and I got her a little sandwich, and I got up to pay for it, and I only had enough money for one or the other, and I had to put her sandwich back. You know, I've done a lot of things in my life that I don't share from the podium with very few people. But, you know, I've never done anything in my life that haunted or humiliated me more than that. You know, I got on the bus, and I told my daughter, I said, we don't have enough money. And she saw that bottle of wine I had behind my coat. And she just, I'll never forget that look she gave me. I was the only person in the world that she had. There wasn't anyone else, just me. And she was hungry. And I just sat down in the seat behind her. I couldn't even look at her. And thank God there was this lovely lady on the bus, this black gal. She'd been sitting there, man, watching the whole thing, never saying a word. And she reached over to she went over and sat right next to my little girl and said, honey, she goes, are you hungry? Can you help me eat this lunch? And she took care of my daughter all the way back to California. And the lady, God bless her, she never said one word to me. She was not unkind to me, and she didn't. She just sat there and took care of my daughter and talked to her. And I got back to California, and I did what all heroes do at the end of the road. Went to Mom's house. Told you about my mom, you know. My daughter was my mother's, the apple of her eye. I mean, that was her love. And I had taken her out of her life for 2 years. For 2 years, she didn't know if either one of us were alive or dead. And she opened her door, and she took one look at me, and she looked at her granddaughter, and she was in dirty clothes and long stringy hair and a dirty face. And she reached in, and she grabbed my daughter and pulled her in the house. She shut the door, and she just about, and she looked at me with a look I've never seen her give anyone. She said, you get off my property. If you ever come on my property again, I'll kill you. And she shut the door, and I said, yes, ma'am. You know, and but that was not an idle threat. And, you know, the next few years, I don't know too much about it. I'm just hearsay. I was a wino. I drank wine. I panhandled. I drank Gallo port wine, which was my favorite drink. I drank it until they locked me up, until I did something stupid, until I went into convulsions on a street, until someone beat me up and got in the hospital. And when I got out, I drank wine again. And that's what I did, and I lived on the street, so. And I don't know too much about it, you know. I know that I was arrested on one corner 52 times for drunk in public. I know that I went to Tri-City Hospital with the worst case of sunburn they'd ever seen. And I knew that I was in county mental health a whole bunch of different times, and I was in the county detox a whole bunch of times. And but I was standing in front of this deal one time, and I was sick, and I needed a drink. I was so sick, I couldn't panhandle. I was so sick, I was shaking so bad. And this guy pulled up, and he's getting this four-door sedan, and he's got this square little wife sitting there, and this square little kid sitting in the back. And he got out, and he's got a suit on, and he's got short hair and wingtips. And I looked at him, I said, God, how can you live like that, you know? And he just looked up at me and smiled, and he gave me two crisp $1 bills. And I believed in God one more time, you know, because I got in that store, I got me a quart of wine and a short dog. I got outside, the minute I opened that door, I pulled that cap off and took a big pull on that jug and just laid there until the shaking stopped. I'm leaning against this glass, and I took another pull off, and when I'm looking, I see this family looking at me, sitting in their car, just staring at me, and I know they're judging me, and I turned around and flipped them off, and I cursed them. I took my wine, and I went back down to my little canyon, and I started drinking it. About that time, I had the weirdest thought I'd ever had. You know, I ain't here to talk about religion, because religion has no business in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I will share my experience, strength, and hope. One of my experiences, those people, they were on the way to worship the God of their understanding that day, that whole family, and they weren't judging me. They're good friends of mine today. They all got out of that car that morning, and they prayed for that poor alcoholic, for God to intervene in this. And I'm opening up my bottle of wine, and I'm sucking that bottle of wine, and all kind of have the weirdest thought I've ever had in my life. It says, maybe you ought to go to A&A. And that was really weird. You see, I'd been to AA before. And all those detoxes, those H&I people, you know, come in, bring that big, ugly blue book telling me how wonderful it is to be sober. And that we love newcomers and we'll love you till you can love yourself. And easy does it. And I patiently listened to their drivel, you know, and I would tell them, listen, man, I am not an alcoholic. I'm a drug addict. I just can't afford any drugs right now, you know? And they smiled and they said, you know, if you ever find yourself drinking and you want to stop drinking, you can't stop drinking, come to Alcoholics Anonymous. We love newcomers. And you are the lifeblood, blah, blah, and all this stuff, you know? So you know what? I just tucked that away. And that morning, I'm thinking, I don't know how, but I ended up at a meeting that night, St. Michael's. And the meeting was already started, and I came in the back door. And I remember I walked in that room, and these people looked a lot like you folks, you know. My first impression was that I was at a PTA meeting or something. I mean, they're all squares, you know, and they all look good. They're laughing and joking with each other and smiling, and I'm going, geez. And they turned around and looked at me, and they asked me to identify myself. I drink port wine, and I drink a lot of port wine. And I'm going to tell you the way port wine affects me after an extended drink. You know, I have the most profound thoughts that hit my brain. I mean, they're just incredible. And I try to put them out, and what comes out, you kind of lose something in the translation. But what would come out, I'd stand there and I'd go, ah, and it just gets stuck. It was great for panhandling, you know, but they asked me, I didn't, that's what I did, and they're just kind of looking at me, you know, and I sat down, and I am nervous. I'm going, wow, oh man, these people are all looking and talking, you know, and you know, I've been living in these same clothes for almost 3 years, and my hair came down past my belt, my beard came down to my belly button, you know, and I was covered in wine sores. I weighed about 125, 130 pounds, and a bunch of stuff lived on me besides me. And, it was kind of a science project, you know. How much abuse can a human body take? And, you know, nobody rushed up to love on me, you know. I sat next to this pretty little gal. She scooted all the way down. I'm sitting there, and these people are looking at me, and I'm going, jeez, this was a mistake. I got to get out of here. You know, and they start talking. I listen to what they're talking. They're talking about God. I'm going, oh, no. And then I saw them pass that basket, you know, and I knew they were going to start singing any minute. You know, and I got to get out of this place. This is a big, big mistake. And I stood up to leave, and there was this lady, God bless her. You know, I've never seen this woman since, but this woman saved my life. There was a man talking, and she stood up, and she cut that guy right off. same time I stood up, and she said, you know, she goes, I looked right at me, she said, I walked in these rooms 27 years ago. A cop dropped me off at the back door. Meeting had already started, and I came in the back door, and I looked at all you people. And I thought I was at a PTA meeting. Because everybody was so clean cut, and you looked so clean, and you ladies looked like nice housewives. And I knew that when you turned around and you saw me and saw what I was, I knew you'd turn your back on me the way you always had. She goes, I've been a prostitute on the streets of Los Angeles since I was 14 years old. I've done everything a woman ever had to do to survive out there. And when I saw you people, I felt dirty. And I wanted to leave, but a woman grabbed me and brought me into the room and told me to sit down, put her arm around me, and said, don't go nowhere, we need you. And got her a cup of coffee. Proceeded to talk about the women that taught her how to be a woman. Talked about her sponsor that took her through the steps, about the service of Alcoholics Anonymous. Talked about 27 years of continuous sobriety and service to Alcoholics Anonymous. And she came up in front of all those people that didn't want nothing to do with me, man. She put her arms around me, grabbed me real tight, and kissed me right on the mouth. Bravest woman I've ever known in my life. And this old gal's holding on to me, man, and she gets up in my ear, and she goes, baby, she goes, don't go nowhere. We need you desperately. And she said those words to me, something happened inside. Ain't nobody needed me for a long time. Ain't nobody put a hand out in a loving way to me in a long time. And you know, I've had things happen to me in my life that I ain't gonna tell you from the podium, but I'll tell you this, that nobody in this world's ever made me cry. No matter what you've done to me, you've never made me cry. And I'm standing there in front of all these squares, man, and this little gal's holding on to me, and she says that. All of a sudden, my eyes start getting real wet, and this big rumbling thing starts going in my gut. And I'm standing in front of all these squares, just crying like a baby. And I started coming to A&A. And y'all lied to me, every one of you. You told me my life would get better if I'd stop drinking alcohol. I have no idea what alcohol did for those people, but I'm going to tell you here and now, alcohol is not my problem. It never has been my problem. It probably never will be my problem. Now, my alcohol consumption has caused some of you problems, probably. It's caused my family a lot of problems. It's caused the state of California a lot of problems, but it's never caused me a problem. You see, my problem is I have an acute allergic reaction to sobriety. At about 3 days without anything in my body that affects me from the neck up, man, I go under a thing called stark raving sober. And everything is so real, and I cannot, how do you ever go to sleep? You know? How do you listen to all those people talking in there at the same time? And then you start remembering, the stuff starts coming back, the stuff that you've done, you know? And how do you live with that? And I'd have to drink. God, I just have to. I didn't know how you guys could not drink. And I'd come here, and you know, and I'd stay sober as long as I could, and I'd have to drink. And I came to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous for a number of years. I came to these meetings, and I stole your money every chance I got, you know. I passed out on your floors, pissed on your floors, thrown up on your floors. I chased your women, not very successfully. You know, I've done everything there is to get kicked out of anything. And you know what everyone always told me? Keep coming back. How the hell do you get kicked out of here? You know? You just kick me out of here, I can got a reason, you know? Didn't work, man. They won't let me back in. Told me to keep coming back, and I kept coming back, and I kept coming back. It was this period I got to know Barbara, you know? And me and Barbara became very good friends. You know, I came to Christmas morning, 1983, butt naked, completely hog-tied in the rubber room. Cops had beat me so bad, my face was stuck to the mat, and I'm trying to peel my face off. You know, and I finally get peeled off and roll over, and I look up, and the cops are looking at me, and I know Santa Claus ain't coming. They let me go. And I went back to my place. I started drinking. On January 6th, of 1984. I hit the place they talk about in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and A Vision for You. It has such a special meaning to me. It says there'll come a time where you can imagine life with alcohol, and you can't imagine life without it. And you've been in AA, and AA don't work for you no more. AA just don't work for you. And all of a sudden, alcohol don't work for you. You will know loneliness such as few people on this earth can even imagine. And if that's a one word at any meeting. It doesn't matter where we come from, what gender, what sex, what color, what station in life. There's no class of people in the world that understand what the word lonely means, like an alcoholic. If loneliness would have been a tangible thing, it would have absolutely eaten me alive. It says you come to the jumping off spot and you want for the end. You know, when I realized, man, what was going on, that alcohol wasn't doing its thing, I pulled out my gun, I pulled it up to my heart, and I pulled the trigger, and I blew my left lung and two ribs out. It knocked me all the way across the room. I'm sliding down this wall, and the only thought I think is, God, thank God this is over with. Let me out of here. And I come to in this hospital. You thought I died, didn't you, huh? You know, I hear the people say, you know, for me to drink is to die. Only if you're lucky. I won't die. I'll be a 198-year-old wino. Sick, next to a dumpster, trying to get one more short dog. The loneliest human being on the face of the earth. I know that. There's been times in the last 18 years, if I could have got a guarantee I would have died if I drank, I guarantee I would have drank. Dying don't scare me. Living in that world I lived in scares me to death, you know. This old guy, Charlie Tuck, was at the foot of my bed when I come to. And I'm thinking he's going to start preaching this A&A to me. You know, Charlie, I hated that old man. Man, I saw him at a meeting one time. He came up to me in this meeting and said, he looked me right in the eye. He said, you think you're pretty tough, don't you, kid? I said, I'm tough enough. Don't you ever doubt that. He looked me right in the eye, gave me this big grin. He says, you ain't tough. He says, you're the scaredest son of a bitch in this room. Now, that might make you dangerous, but it don't make you tough. And he walked away laughing at me, you know. Man, I avoided that man like the plague. And I hope to him, there's Charlie Talk. And I'm going, oh, God, I've gone to hell, man. And Charlie's here, you know. And I'm condemned for eternity to be preached to from this big book, you know. And Charlie had these two young new guys with him, man. And their eyes were real big like saucers looking down at me. And I'm going, oh, God, you know. And here it comes. And Charlie goes, you see this pitiful thing laying here? And they go, yeah. He goes, this is what happens to an alcoholic who doesn't take the steps. Come on, let's go. May 12, 1984. I come through the same way I've come through a thousand times. I come through the very first thought I have is, shit, I'm still alive. And the next one is, I got to get something in me as fast as I can. And then I had the weirdest thought, because I've been here, coming here for so long, that you people had all poisoned my mind, you know? I mean, it just totally brainwashed me. Because, you know, at 5:30 in the morning, sicker than a dog shaking, I'm thinking about the ABCs that's read at the end of chapter 5. That is a strange thing to think about at 5:30 in the morning. And he says, you know, it says that I'm powerless over alcohol. I'm an alcoholic. I know I'm an alcoholic. I have no problem with this denial stuff I hear people talking about. I have paperwork from the state of California classifying me as a chronic alcoholic. You know, what's the big deal? And, you know, alcohol works. Alcohol allows me to function in this world one day at a time. You know, I can't live without it. He said, I'm powerless, you know, and it doesn't matter what I admit to you people. It don't matter what I admit to my probation officer or even a sponsor. That first step, there's only one step we got to do absolutely perfect, and that's the first one. If you can't do that one perfect, you're wasting your time on the rest of them. He says, I'm powerless, and it was my innermost self in here where I live. I have to totally accept the fact that I am powerless over alcohol. And I started thinking, what the hell does that mean? And I remembered that day. It was like God gave me a vision of that morning on that bus with my daughter. And I guarantee you, I would give my life, the drop of a hat, for my daughter at any time. But under the influence of alcohol, I put one drop of alcohol on my body, and that alcohol becomes more important than even feeding my daughter. Alcohol is my master. It tells me where I can go, when I can go. It tells me how far I can go. It tells me who I can hang with. It tells me when I got to go to sleep. It tells me when I got to get up. There's no room for another human being in my life unless you're buying. You know, and I finally understood, no matter what, when I drink, it don't matter about who I love, what I love, my morals, they're gone. I will do whatever I got to do to get another drink as soon as I put that drop of alcohol in my body. And then I got to that next part, it says that no human power was ever going to fix me. I kept hoping one of you gals were going to fix me. You know, some of you tried. If you're here tonight, you should have talked to your sponsor, you know. Left me that thing I've been dodging since I got here, man. That's that God stuff. Got down on my knees that morning because I thought about the people in Alcoholics Anonymous, and not only in Alcoholics Anonymous, but in other places, who had exactly what I wanted, and it wasn't their money, it wasn't their women, it wasn't their stuff. It was a way through they walked through this life with dignity no matter what. And they had a little sparkle in their eye. And all these people talked about this same thing. They talked about this power. They did for them what they could not do for themselves. And I got on my knees that morning. I said, you know, I don't know who you are, and I don't know what you are, and I sure hope it don't make any difference. But I'll do whatever you put in front of me from this day forward if I don't have to drink. And I got back up to Charlie Tuck's house, because where else am I going to go? And I asked Charlie to sponsor me. Charlie detoxed me at his house with orange juice and K-Rose syrup, you know. And I sat there first couple of days over on Barbara's couch. I went to Charlie's house. These guys came over and told me their stories. I sat in this room and listened to tapes, and he started taking me to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. He started getting me involved in service. He taught me how to pray. He taught me about what the most important word in Alcoholics Anonymous is that I've seen in the little time I've been here. I've seen it get real watered down. To my ability in every area of my life, you know. He got me involved in service. He made me get a job. He made me get an identification in my real name. He made me be in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous every single night. He said, you stand at that door, you shake hands with every person that walks in there. You don't tell them anything about you unless they ask. You don't borrow any money from anybody. Leave the chicks alone, you know. And that's what he did. You know, and I started going to meetings. He got me in service, and things started happening in my life. His liver's here. I mean, that's the only reason you'd have a cell phone in a meeting, isn't it? When you're waiting for that transplant. Good luck. Now I got to start over from the beginning. I'm totally lost. You know, I met her in Alcoholics Anonymous. There's a her for all of us, or him, or an it, or whatever, you know. There's someone here waiting for us, you know. I met her. We fellow. She liked to fish. She got sober on the same day. It had to be God's will, and we got married. And me and Connie, we had a great marriage for many, many years. We were both very active in Alcoholics Anonymous, very active in the Hospital Institutional Committee. We were sponsoring people. We were doing the deals. You know, we started a business that became very profitable. We got the house. We got the boat. We got all the stuff. We got to travel around the world. I got custody of my kids. State of California gave me my driver's license back after 3 years, which is a 45-minute pitch in itself. You know, State of California gave my license back. That same day, I passed a contractor's test. I got my license as a contractor in the state of California. And I came home, and I bought a brand new pickup truck because my sponsor wouldn't let me buy anything on credit. You know, I had to pay cash for everything, and I had to wait till I had a license. I had to have insurance. I had to have all those things in line before I could do anything. And I got a phone call, and it was this girl, and she says, "Is your name Kip?" And I said, "Yeah." She goes, "Well, did you know so-and-so?" I said, "Oh, years ago." She goes, "That's my mother." She goes, and you're my father, and I've been trying to find you for almost 15 years. And that little girl that was born so many years ago, she came into my life. And she brought me three little grandkids, you know, and I got to go make amends to her mother and her family. And I got to know him and bring him into my life, you know. That little boy, Men and Alcoholics Anonymous. Doctors told me to pray that he died. I got involved in Special Olympics. I got involved in his life. I got involved in his school. And he grew up for 10 years in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And when he was 23 years old, he graduated from the Riverside School of Death in Riverside. He graduated from high school. And then he wore his gown and his hat, and he walked down the aisle, and he gave me his diploma, you know. And you guys gave me that. You know, that little girl that I drug all over the country. A man came up one day and asked me for her hand in marriage. He said, your daughter said that I have to have your permission. I threw that right away years ago. I said, you have to have your permission to marry your daughter. You know, and I talked to him, and I got to know him, and I gave him my permission, and I gave him a beautiful wedding that I still pay for. It's been 8 years. I will always pay for it, you know, forever and ever and ever. And I don't regret anything, you know. And that little girl spent 13 years going to night school. And she became, got her master's degree in special education, and she works with brain damage young people. She's been married 8 years. They've never had a fight. She called me 2 days ago and said, Daddy, I'm going to give you a grandbaby in July. I threw all that away. You guys gave it back to me. You know, I've gotten to travel around the world, and I came back from Australia after 2 months, and I was over there, and I came back, and I opened up the newspaper reading it, and I'm reading the front end of this story about a woman. A man broke into her house and raped her and cut her to pieces right in front of her children. And it was my daughter. And you know, I don't know about y'all, but I'll tell you, I'm absolutely perfectly capable of first-degree murder if you touch my children. And I went insane. I just went absolutely nuts. I went to the hospital. He didn't kill her, but she lost most of her face and her breast and her left arm. And I saw, but she didn't look human. And everything got real ice cold in me. And I didn't know what to do. You know, one of the very first things my sponsor told me when I asked him to sponsor me, and he laid out a program of action for me. He says, you know, people like you don't get sober. You don't even get sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. You're an alcoholic of the absolute hopeless variety. It's obvious to me that God has opened a window for you. I suggest you step through, and this is the way it's going to have to be one day at a time all the days of your life. And that is one simple fact. That absolutely nothing, no woman, no job, no child, no nothing in this world can ever be more important than you doing the things you have to do to maintain your sobriety. And that's a lot more than just attending a meeting. And he laid out that for me, man, and I'm going through that emotional pain, and I can't talk about it, man. I want to make plans for this man, and all this stuff is going on, and I'm reading that book, and I got this resentment that goes way beyond any resentment that anyone else has ever had, I figure, in the whole world. And I'm looking for a, I'm not looking for a solution, I'm looking for a loophole, man. You know, and I'm looking in that book, man. I'll tell you, if someone here's got a resentment in here tonight about anything, I've done vast research on this. We are not allowed the dubious luxury of living with hate and anger in our hearts because it cuts us off from the sunlight of the Spirit, which is God. Very beginning of the book tells me that lack of power is my dilemma. The whole purpose of this book is for me to tap into that power that'll solve my life, my problems, and hang on to that. Bottom of page 62, it says, here's the how and the why of it. First of all, we had to quit playing God. And the third step, I don't have a right to stand in judgment of any man, woman, or child for anything they've done. My job is to be an interested observer in everything that's going on. And I am responsible for my actions, my reactions, and my inactions on everything that happens to me. It says in there, if I got a resentment that I can't get rid of, I got to go pray for that human being to have everything out of life I want. And the hardest thing I've ever done is to pray for that animal every single day. And the insanity worked. You know, I'm not telling you I forgive him. I'm not going to stand here and lie to you. It's something I worked on. He was just released from prison. He lives 2 miles from me. You know, and that's one thing I pray on a daily basis, you know. Not today, God. Not today, you know. But you know what? He's got a funny sense of humor. I'll probably end up sponsoring him within the next few years. And I would, you know. I got through that, you know. I was able to be there to take care of my daughter and my grandchildren. I had the financial ability to do that. And I was there for her the one time she needed me the most in her life as a result of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and the fellowship and the love that you people gave me. You know, right after that, they told me I had cancer, you know, and I had to go through a major surgery. And I had to do that surgery without any pain medication. And I'm not telling anybody what to do with your medications. It ain't none of my business. You do anything you want to do. You see, but I got a lot of brain damage. I spent most of my brain cells on cheap wine and good drugs, you know. I got two of them left. One says I want to, the other says I better not. I'm scared to death I'll kill the wrong one, you know. But I do know this, with all of my heart, with all of my heart, that no matter what I got to do to stay sober, it's easier to stay sober than to get sober again. That's all I know, you know. And I don't know if God will ever open that window for me again. I don't know if he'll ever open it for me again. I don't play no games with my sobriety. I don't take anything that affects me from the neck up. I've been through 3 major surgeries on aspirin and Novocaine, and I've not done one of them with dignity. You know, not one of them. I sniveled and whined and bitched and complained, but I don't allow anybody to put anything in my body. You know, I'm responsible for my recovery, not any doctor or no one else. I'm responsible for it. I research anything that goes in my body to make sure of that before I take it, you know. And we'll add to that, I've watched so many people in this program die, because, oh, the doctor said it's okay for me to take a Vicodin, my back hurts, you know. And I go to their funerals over and over and over. I'm glad. I don't know about you, man. I'm joy in my life. I'm putting nothing in me for nothing, you know. But I got on the other side of that, you know, and my wife came up to me one day, and I love this woman, and she said, Chip, I got to tell you something. I go, what's that? She goes, I'm a lesbian, and I'm leaving. And I'm going, what? I didn't think she was going to tell me that, you know. I got angry, man. I got mad. I started calling her names. I don't know what to do. And, you know, it's all about me, of course, you know. And I go talk to Father Bill Wilson, you know, and I'm starting, you know, she's Catholic. I'm Catholic. We're going to run it all down, man. I'm ratting her off to the church is what I'm doing, you know. And I'm telling Father Bill about, you know, about this horrible deed this woman has done, you know. And Father Bill looks at me. I get all done. He goes, I said, so what do you think, Father? He goes, I think you're disgusting. I go, no, maybe you weren't listening. He goes, oh, I was listening. He goes, you ever bothered to read page 62 in the big book, 61, the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous? I go, yeah. He goes, you know, that guy thought he could wrest satisfaction out of life if he only managed, did everything just right. Well, how does that apply to me? He goes, you keep telling me what a great husband you were, what you did this, you did that, and how much you love her and all, blah, 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 blah. So that what you're telling me is that everything you ever did for her, you had a hook in it. There was a condition on your love. I'm going, no, she's my wife. She goes, that doesn't mean she's your property. You know, you're not in charge of her sexuality. That's between her and God. He goes, you know what I see is she was honest with you until it jeopardized her sobriety, and she thought enough of you to get honest with you and get honest with herself. You know, and I applaud her, and you owe her an amends. I hate that stuff. And I made amends, you know, and I've tried to remain friends with her, and you know, and I gave her anything she wanted, and I wanted out of that marriage, you know, and everything in this world, you know. I got hit, attacked by a dog right after that. I almost lost my right arm. Couldn't work anymore. They took the house, they took the business, they took everything. Everything was gone. Me and my dog and my son. And my son got sick. I had to take him to the hospital, and I sat him with that hospital for 3 months, and he died in my arms. You know where my son died? In the big book, and right after his ninth step, it talks about some promises. It says it will know serenity. I'll tell you what serenity has been for me. Serenity is being able to watch the things I love the absolute most in this world die, leave, horribly scarred. And after I get through my part of it, when I get to the other side of it, I understand that God is in charge of everything to do with my life, and He doesn't make mistakes. And I know that without a shadow of a doubt. And that's serenity. I know God's in charge of everything. Nothing happens by mistake. My object is to be an interested observer and pay attention and learn for everything that happens to me in my life, and knowing that every person I meet is my teacher, that every event is a lesson that I can learn and grow to be the man that my God envisioned me to be when He made me. You know, if I stand in judgment of it and say this is good and this is bad and they're an asshole and they're blah, 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 I'm playing God. And when I play God, I get resentful. How many of you people this morning got up on your hands and knees on your morning meditation and said, what can I do to make Chip Collins' life a little bit easier today? See, not one of you. Not one of you. You're all thinking about yourself. But I have this illusion that you're supposed to be thinking about me. It's always been my problem, you know. You know, I got through all that, you know, and I went to school, and, you know, and I wanted to jam a woman in my life, you know, and I was telling my sponsor, I'm lonely, because you're not lonely, you're horny, and, you know, and he gave me, you know, Jerry Conine, he gave me the greatest bit of advice anyone has ever given me. But I called him about that, and I told him, and he says, Chip, it's absolutely impossible for an alcoholic to have a relationship if they need one. Mostly I see a lot of people cringe every time I say that. Because you're not capable of having a relationship with a woman until you don't need a woman in your life to validate you as a man. You're looking for another human being to fix you and make you feel whole. You're trying to use someone. All you're going to do is hurt someone. Because you can't have a relationship until you don't need a woman in your life. And you're comfortable and you're a whole human being. Then you have something to offer someone, you know. And I listened to him, you know, and I said, can I date? He said, well, yeah, but, you know, keep it real cool. And I did. And one day, I was sitting, and my little girl called me and asked me to come out and go out to dinner. And I said, I'm watching a game, and maybe I'll take a rain check. And I went, well, where did that come from, you know? And right after that, I sit there, and I went, wow. This is what he was talking about. I don't need a woman. I said, but you know what, God? If it be your will, I'd love to experience true love one more time. 2 weeks later, the woman I'd had an affair with, her mother brought me a 3-month-old baby and gave me true love. 1 year after that, I met the love of my life and we got married. A year and a half after that, I have another son and I cut the cord. And today I live in a nice house and I have a wonderful family. My son's 5 years old. We were fishing the other day. He got on my lap. He put his arm around me and he looked me right in the eye and he said, Kip, he said, Dad, I want to tell you something. He goes, you can't hide from God. I went, cool. You know? You know, I've gone over. I tend to do that, you know, but my message to you is this, especially you new people. You don't ever have to drink again. You don't ever have to know that loneliness again. The program of Alcoholics Anonymous is absolutely flawless. It works absolutely perfect 100% of the time. It'll work for absolutely anybody, anywhere, under any circumstances, for as long as you're willing to do this deal, but probably not a minute longer. You know, this takes everything you've got. I want to thank you all for letting me be here, and thank you for your patience.
Thank you, Kip, for sharing with us.